In the hidden heart of Guyana's emerald rainforest, a slender dugout canoe slices through mirror-still water under a copper dawn sky. Its paddle echoes centuries of wisdom and ancestral memory. On board, a young boy peers ahead. Beside him perches a parrot, silent witness to a journey into a Merindian life. Each ripple, each carved line of bark carries stories of ancient boat-building rituals passed from father to son. This is not a tourist postcard. It is a living, breathing culture. We will explore the village festivals, the deep-rooted myths of shape-shifting hunters, the sacred craft of canoe making, and the powerful ceremonies of fermented cassava drinks. We will meet elders weaving woven combs and children learning to swim before they walk. You will sense how water, wood, and song bind these communities to the land and to each other. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Path of the Paddle. Arrival in the Rupununi. The morning mist clung to the tall blades of savanna grass like breath on glass. In the far south of Guyana, where the sky begins to touch the forest canopy and the land opens into the vast savanna of the Rupununi, a stillness lingers that feels sacred. This is the ancestral territory of the Makushi, Wapishana, Waiwai, and other Amerindian nations who have called this region home for thousands of years. We begin in Anai, a small but culturally rich village perched on the edge of the North Rupununi. The air is sweet with the smell of cassava roasting over firewood. A chorus of cicadas hums from the tree line. And not far from the village clearing, the Burro Burro River flows quietly, cutting through the jungle like a lifeline. Along its banks, long dugout canoes rest in the mud, some fresh with carvings, others with paint faded by time and weather. Here, the canoe is not a relic. It is a living tool, a way of life. Elder Akima, her eyes soft but sharp as arrowheads, greets us in Makushi. Her hands are stained with the juices of genep fruit, used to mark symbols on the freshly carved paddles. "You cannot understand who we are," she says, "without coded into tools, objects, and movements. These are living alphabets, constantly evolving yet deeply rooted in history. Even the act of cooking can carry symbolism. Certain spoons are carved with fish tails to bless the food with abundance. Some calabashes have sunburst carvings to honor the morning. Knots in rope can signify strength in marriage or serve as talismans during journeys upriver. Kai brings us one final item before sunset, a flute carved from bone. Along its sides are rows of dots and curves. He blows gently, and the sound it makes is high, sharp, and haunting. This flute belonged to my great-grandfather, he says. When we carve, we don't just shape the wood, we shape time. As night falls and fireflies light the jungle like drifting stars, we begin to understand. In this world, everything speaks. If you listen closely enough, the trees whisper stories. The paint on your arm remembers your grandmother's songs. And a carved paddle carries not just a man, but a legacy. Chapter 5. Gathering the Earth. Plants, medicines, and the women who know the forest breathe with memory. In the hush of early morning, long before the sun pierces the canopy, the soft footsteps of women can be heard moving through the underbrush. They carry baskets slung from their foreheads and machetes wrapped in cloth. Their destination isn't far, but their knowledge reaches back generations. These are the keepers of Guyana's living pharmacy, the women who speak the language of plants. Among the indigenous communities of Guyana, women are the primary gatherers and healers. They do not call themselves herbalists or shamans. They are simply women, mothers, grandmothers, aunties, who were taught by those before them to listen to the forest, to observe the colors of leaves, the scent of bark, the curve of a vine. What they know is not written down. It is remembered in touch, taste, and timing. We join Ivelis, a Makushi elder with a warm smile and eyes that never stop scanning the treetops. She walks with a quiet confidence, stopping to brush her fingers across a cluster of leaves or to sniff the air like a tracker. She crouches at the base of a tree and cuts a strip of bark with practiced ease. "This is yare," she says. "It brings down fever. We boil it with ginger and pepper leaves. You'll sweat out the sickness by morning." Her basket already holds a mix of herbs and roots, bold in scent, subtle in color. There's kukama, a vine that soothes snake bites, and kawakawa, used to calm the belly and spirit. There's the root of the mora tree, boiled to ease labor pains. Every plant has a use. Every use has a story. She speaks of a time when the forest was their only medicine cabinet, before hospitals, before pills, before cars. When a child had a cough, she says, "We didn't run. We listened. Was it dry? Was it wet? Was there a moon? The forest tells you what to do. You just have to respect it." Back in the village, under a shade tree, women gather to sort and prepare what they've harvested. Leaves are crushed in calabash bowls. Roots are dried in the sun. Oils are extracted by hand. Some remedies are mixed with cassava beer. Others are brewed with wild honey or fermented fruits. Every preparation is tied to time, to the hour of day, the stage of the moon, or the season of the rain. One young mother, Liana, grinds seeds with a stone and sprinkles them into boiling water. "For colic," she explains, rocking her baby in one arm. "My grandmother used this. My daughter will too." Her voice carries no urgency, only certainty, the calm of someone standing on a foundation older than the village itself. Healing here is not just physical. It is spiritual. When a person is thought to be touched by forest sadness, the healer prepares a cleansing bath with bitter bush and moonflowers. The person must soak in the river while elders sing softly, asking the spirits of the land to forgive and release. This type of healing is common after emotional events, grief, betrayal, or nightmares that linger too long. Ceremonies also play a role. During the full moon, women often gather around a central fire with herbs to share. They trade seeds, stories, and laughter. Young girls are taught to identify leaves by scent. "Close your eyes," an auntie will say, holding up a bundle. "Now tell me what it is by memory." Knowledge is layered. Some plants are for everyday use. Fevers, cuts, insect bites. Others are sacred and reserved only for major life moments. Birth, marriage, death, or spiritual visions. There are herbs that enhance dreams and others that suppress them. Roots that strengthen fertility, and vines that bring sleep without nightmares. One plant, called Minari, is always treated with reverence. It's said to reveal truth if brewed and drunk at night. Only elders are allowed to touch it, and never without first offering a prayer. We visit a small garden on the edge of the village, tended entirely by women. It's more than a garden. It's a map of their culture. Each plant is paired with a story stone, hand-painted with a symbol, a spiral for protection, a fish hook for strength, a leaf for letting go. Mothers bring their children here not just to teach, but to remind, of lineage, of land, of responsibility. One girl places her hand on a plant and closes her eyes. Her mother watches, saying nothing. This is how learning works here. Through silence, through presence, through time. Before we leave, Ivelisse gives us a single dried leaf wrapped in cloth. "Boil this if your spirit feels tired," she says, and sit by the river. Don't speak, just listen. As the sun dips low, painting the forest in amber light, we walk away feeling changed. The women of Guyana's Amerindian culture carry more than herbs and vines. They carry a sacred trust, not only to heal bodies, but to keep their people rooted in the earth. In the next chapter, we'll explore the communal spirit of Amerindian festivals, vibrant celebrations where dance, song, and food come together to honor land, life, and legacy. Chapter 6, Songs of the Forest, Festivals, Firelight, and the Spirit of Celebration. Night falls differently during festival season. The forest doesn't fall asleep. It leans in, listening. The drums begin long before dusk, echoing through the canopy, as if awakening spirits older than memory. Firelight flickers along the riverbanks. Smoke curls through the air, scented with cassava bread, roasted fish, and pepper-laced stews. This is not just celebration. It is the heartbeat of Amerindian culture, and it pulses strongest when the village gathers as one. We've arrived at a time of great joy. Fagua has passed, the rains have slowed, and the cassava harvest is good. It's the season for the Makushi Kamarang, a multi-day gathering that honors the ancestors and celebrates the unity of river and forest life. Villagers arrive from as far as 2 days away, paddling down tributaries in hand-carved canoes, adorned in vibrant paint, feathers, and beadwork. Elders line the village entrance to welcome them, sprinkling water and ash across the path, a cleansing ritual. Children run barefoot between visitors, their laughter competing with the crackle of open fires and the distant thump of drum beats. In the center of the gathering grounds stands a tall ceremonial post wrapped in cloth, dyed with turmeric and jenipapo. Offerings sit at its base: fruit, handmade tools, feathers, and bits of carved wood. These are symbolic gifts to the land, a way of saying thank you for another year of life. At sunset, the first dance begins. A circle forms, women on one side, men on the other. The rhythm is steady, ancient. Maracas rattle, drums thud like footsteps of a god. Feet pound the earth in unison, raising dust like breath. Voices rise in call and response. The lyrics shift between Makushi, Wapishana, and YY dialects, yet everyone understands. It's the language of memory. Each movement in the dance holds meaning. A slow, wide step mimics the walk of a jaguar. A twist of the wrist imitates the fall of rain. A hand on the chest signals gratitude. These are not performances for tourists. They are living traditions, part storytelling, part prayer. Food, too, takes center stage. Women prepare piwari, a fermented cassava drink poured into carved bowls and shared among elders first. It's sweet, strong, and sacred. Piwari is how we bind the circle, one woman says. You cannot argue with someone you've drunk piwari with. Dishes laid out on banana leaves form a feast of deep cultural pride. Fire roasted laba, cassava pone, boiled wild yams, and wild bush tea brewed with lemongrass and cinnamon bark. Everything is harvested, caught, or gathered by hand. Nothing is wasted. Each bite is an act of thanksgiving. As the night deepens, the sacred fire is lit. Around it, storytellers step forward. The first is a blind elder named Amaniko, whose voice alone hushes the gathering. He tells the tale of the river woman who turned into a tree, of the warrior who paddled into the moon, and of the stone that cries when children are lost in the forest. No one interrupts. Even the smallest child listens. Storytelling during festivals is a rite. It transfers knowledge, binds generations, and warns of forgetting. Often, these stories are improvised, told differently each time, yet always carrying the same truth. The rhythm of speech follows the fire's dance. The forest responds in silence. Younger villagers then offer their own gifts, songs, flute performances, or skits dramatizing old tales. One group reenacts a playful story about the jaguar and the trickster monkey, drawing roars of laughter. Another group sings a mourning song for a grandmother who passed the year before. Tears mix with smiles. Celebration is never far from sorrow in these lands. Both are part of the same circle. By dawn, the village is quieter, but not asleep. Some rest in hammocks. Others walk to the river to wash off the night. A group of girls gathers flower petals to prepare for the next day's ritual. Tomorrow, they'll honor the spirits of the unborn, children lost or never born, by placing petals into the water and singing lullabies known only to the women. One elder tells us, "Our festivals are not just for dancing. They are for reminding who we are, what we owe, and what must never be forgotten." As we prepare to leave, we are given a small bundle, dried cassava, wrapped in palm leaf, tied with a red thread, a blessing, a reminder that we are now part of the story too. In the final chapter, we explore how these customs, symbols, and sacred lifeways face the tides of modernity, and how Amerindian communities are finding ways to adapt, protect, and reclaim their voice in the present world. Chapter 7, Living Legacies, Resistance, Renewal, and the Future of the First People. Change flows like a river. Sometimes it nourishes. Sometimes it erodes. For Guyana's indigenous peoples, the current of modern life brings both promise and peril. In the final stretch of our journey, we witness the quiet resistance, creative renewal, and fierce pride that define the Amerindian spirit today. At first glance, a village like Sarama or Woweta seems untouched by time. There are still palm-thatched roofs, hammocks under starlit skies, and elders teaching by firelight. But listen closely, and the rhythm has shifted. A school bell rings in the distance. A teenage girl scrolls on an awao, solar-powered phone. A motorbike replaces a canoe in the early morning rush to the health center. The outside world has arrived, and with it, questions. What does it mean to remain indigenous in a digital age? Can traditions live beside cell towers? Can a culture rooted in oral memory survive when younger generations speak more English than Makushi? These are not abstract concerns. They live in the hearts of every family. We meet Thalia, a 24-year-old teacher who speaks three languages and leads her village's cultural preservation group. She wears a blue school uniform, but teaches her students to dance the Kowali step barefoot on the community grounds. She encourages them to document their grandparents' stories by voice recording, turning old tales into digital archives. "We are not trying to go backward," she says. "We are trying to go forward with our roots." Across Guyana, similar stories are unfolding. Villages are electing to manage their own tourism initiatives, offering eco lodges, guided river tours, and storytelling nights that support community needs while protecting culture. They welcome visitors, not as entertainers, but as educators. But the battle is not only cultural, it is legal. Land rights remain one of the most urgent issues. Though Amerindian communities make up nearly 10% of Guyana's population, they have often had to fight to secure recognition of the lands their ancestors lived on for centuries. Organizations like the Amerindian Peoples Association have stepped in to help map these territories, file legal claims, and push for political protection. We sit in on a village meeting where elders discuss a proposed mining operation nearby. The atmosphere is tense. A company has offered money, schools, and roads, but at the cost of cutting into a sacred forest where burial grounds lie. A long silence follows. Then an elder stands and says, "We don't eat silver. We don't drink oil. What we have is the forest. That's our inheritance." And so they vote. No to the mine. This is what resistance looks like. Quiet, firm, rooted in land and memory. Yet renewal is blooming too. In St. Cuthbert's Mission, a renowned indigenous artist named Oswald Husbands, paints ancestral symbols with contemporary techniques. His canvas becomes a bridge between old and new. In Aishalton, women are reviving the ancient tradition of cotton spinning and hammock weaving, teaching workshops that travel across regions. In Paramakatoy, youth are learning digital mapping to help preserve hunting routes and resource zones. Technology is not the enemy, forgetting is. Even among the youngest, seeds of identity are being watered. During a school assembly in Annai, we watch a group of children perform a poem in their native tongue. It ends with the line, "I am not behind the times. I am beside the river, and indeed, that river flows on." We return one final time to the water's edge. An old man sits on a carved bench, smoothing the side of a half-finished canoe. He tells us this will be his last build. His hands tremble now, but he smiles, saying his grandson will finish the work. The boy is already shaping paddles in the back, each stroke a lesson passed on. As the sun sets behind the forest, the canoe gleams with oil and memory. The Amerindian peoples of Guyana are not relics. They are not locked in museums or frozen in time. They are living, breathing, adapting, growing like vines around change, rooted in soil no colonizer could fully take. Their future is not guaranteed, but it is fiercely guarded. In stories, in rivers, in rituals, in resistance, and in the hands of those still learning to paddle forward without letting go of where they began. Understanding the water. We are people of the river. The canoe in Amerindian culture is not merely a means of transport. It is a sacred extension of the land, crafted from the trunks of softwood trees, kumaka, or cedar. It is carved by hand using axes, fire, and precise eye judgment. There is no formal measuring tape, just inherited knowledge. A father teaches a son, a brother learns from a cousin. Sometimes, women sing while the canoe is being shaped, their voices believed to bless the hollow trunk and protect its journey. We are invited to join a family of canoe builders. The father, Reynaldo, uses fire to soften the wood, placing glowing coals along the center to help widen the hull. His young daughter gathers water from the river in a calabash, dousing the flames before the canoe burns too deep. Reynaldo explains that balance is everything, not just in structure, but in spirit. If the canoe is angry, he says, it will flip you. You must make peace with it. By midday, the sun hangs directly above the savanna, and it's time to test the canoe. We walk behind them through the brush, past cassava farms and fish traps woven from vines, until we reach the river again. The new canoe is launched. It glides forward with a kind of silent grace. As the paddle dips in rhythm, the family begins to chant an old Makushi River song, soft and low, barely above the sounds of birds and breeze. These chants are ancient. Passed down orally, they are sung during canoe launches, harvest rituals, and even funerals. One verse speaks to a spirit that lives in the water, watching over those who travel downstream. Another warns of the Kanaima, a shapeshifter of the forest known to stalk the unaware. As we float downriver, we pass other villages, their roofs thatched with palm, their people waving from the shore. Fishing nets hang between branches. Children leap into the water with no hesitation, laughing as they swim with practiced ease. For them, the river is not a danger but a playground, a school, a road. Even toddlers are trained early, taught to respect the pull of the current and the bite of piranhas. We pull ashore for lunch, eating cassava bread with salted fish wrapped in banana leaves. The conversation drifts to stories, how a boy once carved a canoe too shallow and was swallowed by the rapids, how a grandmother still travels alone upriver to visit her sister with nothing but a paddle and prayer. By evening, a ceremony begins. a small gathering under a moonlit canopy. Maracas shake softly. Fireflies blink like spirits. The village elder offers a drink of paracari, a fermented cassava brew reserved for rituals. It is earthy, thick, and surprisingly sweet. We are told that no canoe should set out on a major journey unless its builder has first made a gift to the river, a sliver of cassava bread, a carved bead, a word of thanks. Looking around, it becomes clear that the canoe is more than transportation. It is memory. It is migration. It is the spiritual bridge between the forest and the village, between the old ways and the uncertain future. As the fire crackles and the stars emerge, Elder Akima speaks once more. Our stories are inside the wood. Listen when the paddle hits the water. That's the voice of our ancestors. In this chapter, we've only begun to understand what the canoe means to Guyana's indigenous people. In the next, we'll dive deeper into their customs, exploring traditional roles, family structures, and the changing face of Amerindian identity in a modernizing world. Chapter 2, Circles of Life, Family, Spirit, and the Amerindian Hearth. At sunrise, smoke curls gently from clay chimneys across the village, rising into the pale sky like prayers. The scent of roasted cassava and pepper pot hangs in the air. Children chase each other barefoot, their laughter echoing between houses raised on stilts. Dogs bark lazily, and birds trill songs that seem older than the trees. Here in the heart of Guyana's interior, the rhythm of life is not rushed. It flows in cycles, like the rivers that shape this land. The Amerindian hearth is more than a place to cook. It is the spiritual center of the home. In the Makushi, Patamona, and Wapishana cultures, the hearth fire is kept burning throughout the day. It is rarely left to go cold. Around it, stories are told, dreams are shared, and meals become rituals. We visit the home of Maria, a Wapishana matriarch with silver braids and strong hands. She tends her fire while grinding cassava root with a wooden pestle. Her granddaughter sits nearby weaving a basket, while her sons prepare fishing spears. The division of tasks is not about power, but harmony. Everyone has a role that serves the community. In our way, Maria says, a strong family is one where the youngest learn by watching, not by being told. And so we watch. A teenage girl gently washes cassava pulp in a matapai, a long woven press that squeezes the toxic juice from the root. She learned this from her mother, who learned it from hers. Nearby, an older boy returns with firewood, while his brother oils a bowstring made from bush rope. No one rushes. Each motion is practiced, meaningful. In Amerindian tradition, the family isn't defined by nuclear roles. Uncles may act as fathers. Grandparents often raise children while parents hunt, fish, or gather. Godparents are chosen with care, not for ceremony, but for the emotional legacy they will help shape. Bonds of kinship extend beyond blood. They include the spiritual and the ancestral. Every home has a spirit shelf, a small space above the doorway where objects of personal or cultural importance are kept. A smooth river stone, a carved feather, a dried flower used in a naming ceremony. These items aren't sacred in the religious sense, but they hold deep emotional power. They remind the family of who they are and where they come from. Ritual is part of everyday life. Before any meal, cassava bread is placed in the center of the floor on a palm mat. The eldest breaks it and shares it first. This moment is often quiet. It's a gesture of respect to the ancestors and to the spirit of the land. Children are taught from a young age to greet the river, to thank the tree before harvesting, and to speak softly during storms, because nature is considered alive and listening. One afternoon, we witness a naming ceremony. A newborn girl is held by her grandmother while a small group gathers to bless her with water from the river and smoke from burning herbs. Her name, Nahile, means song of the morning. Names here carry purpose. They reflect the moment of birth, the dreams of the parents, or the wishes of the community. Spiritual life in the Amerindian villages of Guyana is subtle but powerful. It's not defined by grand temples or written texts. Instead, it lives in chants sung before fishing trips, in markings on paddles and baskets, in the quiet acknowledgement of the forest's watchful presence. There are stories too, ancient stories. A woman tells us of the jaguar spirit that protects hunters. A boy recalls his uncle warning him never to whistle at night, lest the kanema come. These tales are not meant to scare, but to teach reverence. They connect the visible world to the unseen. Yet change is always nearby. In recent years, cell towers have brought signal to parts of the interior. School children now wear uniforms and attend government-run schools in the mornings, learning English alongside their native tongues. Some families own smartphones. Solar panels power radios. Elders fear the erosion of oral tradition, yet many embrace this duality with grace. One teacher, herself a descendant of three Amerindian nations, explains, "We are not frozen in time. We are still here, still growing, still teaching." She runs an after-school storytelling circle where children are encouraged to ask questions, challenge myths, and carry tradition forward in new ways. As night falls again, we gather around Maria's fire. A storm brews in the distance. Thunder rolls gently through the hills. She tells us of her own grandmother, who once paddled across the border into Brazil alone, carrying only cassava bread, a basket of herbs, and her infant child. "Courage," she says, "is one of our oldest customs. The flame dances in the hearth. Outside, the wind picks up. Inside, the circle of family remains unbroken, bound by stories, by fire, by the unseen thread that ties generations across time and land." Next, we journey deeper into these traditions, toward a communal ritual of great importance that ties the canoe to both life and death. Chapter 3, Between Worlds, Rituals of Passage and the River's Judgment. The river has many faces. At dawn, it is silent and soft, like the breath of a sleeping elder. By midday, it flows with purpose, pulling canoes across its mirrored surface. But by night, the river becomes something else entirely. It speaks in riddles. Its edges blur with shadow. And for the indigenous peoples of Guyana, this is when the river becomes sacred. This is when it becomes a judge. In Amerindian culture, especially among the Makushi and Wapishana, the river is more than a source of life. It is the passageway between worlds. To be born, to come of age, to die, each of these transitions is marked by water. We begin with a ritual few outsiders ever witness, the wakaru, or passage ceremony for boys on the brink of manhood. It takes place deep in the interior, near the edge of the rainforest. Here, a group of boys, some no older than 13, prepare for a trial that will mark the beginning of their adult journey. Their bodies are painted with black Jenipapo ink, their heads wrapped in red and yellow thread. Their elders chant beside them as a fire is lit at the riverbank. One by one, the boys step into the water, holding a carved paddle as a symbol of their readiness to guide their own lives. They must swim across a quiet bend of the river and return without flinching. No matter the current, no matter the insects, no matter the fears hiding beneath the surface. Elders watch silently, offering no instructions. The silence is part of the test. It is the river that teaches now. When they return, wet and breathless, they are greeted not with applause, but with silence again. They are handed a bowl of parakari, the fermented cassava brew, and invited to sit among the men for the first time. From this point on, they are expected to carry their share of wisdom, labor, and protection. Women have their own rights. In one village near the Kanuku Mountains, we observe the ritual called Miwako. It marks a girl's first moon cycle. She is secluded in a leaf-thatched hut for several days, tended only by older women. There, she is taught the meaning of fertility, respect for the earth, and the responsibility of her voice. Elders speak to her of the spirit animals, said to guide women, the turtle, the howler monkey, the butterfly. She listens. She learns. When she emerges, she is dressed in a white skirt woven from palm threads, her wrists wrapped in vine bracelets. The village gathers. A slow dance begins around her, and she is presented with a carved calabash, a gift that symbolizes the vessel of life. From then on, her name may change, often chosen to reflect something seen in a dream during her seclusion. The name carries new energy, new purpose. But not all rituals are about beginnings. Death, too, is woven into the life of the river. When an elder dies, their body is wrapped in woven mats and placed in a ceremonial hut for a night of mourning. Family members sing, weep, and speak to the spirit of the deceased, asking them to cross peacefully. A small canoe carved from wood is often placed near the body, symbolic transport for the soul. In earlier times, some communities would burn the person's canoe, releasing its spirit so it could guide the soul across the great water. Today, the practice is more symbolic. A piece of the canoe may be floated downriver at dawn, along with a feather or a painted gourd. As it disappears from sight, a final chant is sung, one that names the rivers and forests the person once knew. It is believed that if the canoe tips or is caught in reeds, the spirit may be unsettled. In such cases, a follow-up ceremony may be held to clean the spirit path, using herbs, chants, and shared meals. In all these transitions, birth, adulthood, death, water is present. It is witness. It is the one element that holds memory for the community. The river knows who came before and who will come next. Elders often say that if you sit by the water long enough, you'll hear the names of your ancestors whispered in the current. Not all rites are solemn. Some are celebratory, like the paddle festival held once a year in select villages, where boys and girls race their carved canoes across the water while elders cheer from the banks. There is music, cassava cake, wild honey, and laughter. But even then, a sacred rhythm underpins the fun. Canoes are sprinkled with blessed water before the race. Winners are not those who paddle fastest, but those who show grace, balance, and respect. As one elder tells us, speed fades, spirit stays. That night, under a half-moon sky, we sit again by the water. Crickets chirp in the grass. A frog plops into the shallows. In the distance, we hear the soft swish of a canoe being pulled ashore. The fire crackles, and an old man leans toward us, voice low. "Do you know why we carve the front of the canoe to a point?" he asks. "Because it splits the world. One side is life, one side is death, and we float between." In Guyana's indigenous world, nothing is flat. Nothing is simple. Every object, every act, every ripple in the water carries depth, meaning, memory. Next, we journey deeper into the tangible expressions of this memory. Through the patterns, carvings, tools, and sacred symbols that mark Amerindian life and identity. Chapter 4, Sacred Symbols, Carvings, Paint, and the Language of Memory. Symbols are the soul of any culture. But in the rain-soaked villages of Guyana's interior, symbols are not written in books or carved into stone monuments. They live in the quiet artistry of everyday life, on the sides of canoes, in the beads around a grandmother's neck, and in the hand-woven patterns of a hammock swinging beneath a thatched roof. To understand the Amerindian spirit, we must first learn to see with different eyes. we begin our day walking with Kai, a young Makushi craftsman whose fingers seem to speak as much as his mouth. His home is simple, raised on stilts, palm thatched, and filled with wood shavings, feathers, and tools carved from bone. On a long wooden bench lies a half-finished paddle, its handle wrapped in cotton thread and its blade etched with spirals and curved lines. "These aren't decorations," Kai says, running his thumb gently over the carvings. "They're maps, stories, warnings. Every Amerindian group in Guyana has its own system of symbols, passed down orally and visually for generations. These symbols appear in canoes, baskets, jewelry, even body paint. For outsiders, they may look like random lines or abstract patterns, but to the trained eye, they tell entire histories. One zigzag line means river flood. A jagged spiral indicates danger ahead. A crisscross pattern symbolizes community, individual lines working together to hold strength. Painted dots on the side of a canoe may reference family lineage or even a spiritual journey that the paddler once survived. We walk with Kai to the community house, where elders gather for midday rest. On the walls, paintings done in natural dyes, crushed berries, jenipapo, and charcoal, depict scenes of animals and mythic figures. One shows a woman giving birth under a tree while a jaguar waits in the shadows. Another displays two canoes drifting apart under a red moon. "They say the jaguar once guarded the sky," an elder explains, pointing to the mural, "until a man stole its voice. That's why the forest is quiet when danger comes." In Amerindian culture, oral, storytelling, and visual symbolism are not separate. They are woven together like the strands of a hammock. For example, the same tale told around a fire may be visualized through a beaded necklace the next morning. A string of red, black, and white beads may honor the spirits of fire, earth, and sky. We meet Nalima, a basket weaver whose patterns are known across several villages. Her hands move with a rhythm that seems tied to an invisible drumbeat. As she weaves, she explains how different plants offer different meanings. The mu vine, for example, is used for baskets intended to carry new life, fruits, herbs, or even a newborn child. It's believed to be strong yet flexible, like a mother's spirit. She pauses, holding up a half-finished basket. "This pattern here means hidden danger," she says. "I weave it into baby baskets to remind the mother that even beauty can bite." One of the most striking traditions we encounter is body painting during ceremonies. Using natural black dye from the genip fruit, villagers paint their faces, arms, and torsos with intricate designs. During festivals or rites of passage, each symbol tells a story of lineage, spirit animals, emotions, or warnings from dreams. During a naming ceremony, a child's body may be marked with dots to reflect ancestors' spirits. Hunters sometimes wear swirling lines on their legs before setting out, said to confuse forest spirits or make them harder to track. Women may paint protective rings around their wrists during childbirth to keep negative forces away. We witness a preparation for such a ceremony in a small Wapishana village. A mother kneels over her daughter, gently painting her forearms with a fine-tipped stick. The daughter stays still, her eyes closed. The brushstrokes are slow and deliberate. "Each mark has memory," the mother says. "Each curve remembers someone who walked before you." Nearby, a large drum made from hollowed wood and animal skin begins to beat. A man dances, his torso painted in triangles and straight lines that represent both direction and fire. Each stomp sends dust into the air. Each swing of his arms follows the pattern painted on his chest. The deeper we look, the clearer it becomes. Amerindian life in Guyana is a language of form, not just words. Their memory is